Hey yo, what is a cipher?
Style over fashion.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to April Walker. Walker is the founder of Walkerwear, a clothing brand that was worn by all of the top entertainers and athletes of the 1990s, from Tupac to LL to Mike Tyson to her neighbor, Biggie Smalls. Walker began her career with a small custom shop in Brooklyn, but early on, she started attracting hip-hop's elite, and she soon began a styling division that dressed artists in countless videos, movies, album covers, tours, and photo shoots. She began her own line, Walkerwear, in 1992. It became a huge success and a favorite brand of many, many stars. Walkerwear ended in 1998, after the oversaturation and subsequent collapse of the urban fashion world. But in 2013, Walker brought back her eponymous company and now sells both retro and new pieces online. We talked to April Walker at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with the man who made the definitive documentary about hip-hop fashion, Sasha Jenkins, on episode 124. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here's the queen of hip-hop fashion, April Walker.
You know, I want to kind of start going back to your dad. Your father was a manager, you know, worked with McCoy Tyner and, you know, a whole bunch of jazz people. And then even kind of got into, I guess, you know, when the 80s and 90s hit, moved into hip hop a little bit with, you know, Curtis Blow and even like very young Jay-Z and jazz. Can you tell me a little bit about your dad?
Sure. Jack Walker is my father and probably how I became an entrepreneur. Didn't realize it at the time that you, as you're growing up, you know, it's funny, all the things kids hate, I think, on a lot. I'm generalizing, but I think when I hear a lot of kids and they talk about their parents and stuff, the things that gets on their nerves, the things that they'll love later, right? Yeah. So for me, my father was an entrepreneur and did things very different. So as a kid, different is kind of like, Dad, you're embarrassing.
Right. Why can't you just be like everyone else? Yeah.
And then you grow up and you become your dad, you know? So for my father, I grew up watching him stay up late, come in late, build a studio in his place. And I'd wake up as a kid, I mean, like 5, 6 years old and be backstage at a jazz concert at 3 a.m. He's babysitting and wearing these different hats. And he was always passionate and still to this day about music. He loves music. Like if that's all he could ever do, that's all he ever would. Like wake up, go and make music. So, you know, that's been him all of his life. And he used to manage McCoy Tyner. Gary Bartz, work with Gary Bartz. Renee McLean is like family for us. Just a lot of the jazz greats that have inspired me by watching them dance to their own beat and just be brilliant in themselves, but also not necessarily be led by a check as much as the passion and the art. So that's the premise of who Jack Walker is and continues and was and continues to be. And just really, I think his blessing and his curse is that he has so many good ideas. And it's, for me, the thing that I'm trying to, as a child, watching him to manage, because we really are inspired by our parents, but we become our parents to a large sense. And so I'm trying to work on that part of it, especially in this second half of my life. It's like, wow, like, I think it's been my blessing and my curse. So my father's worked with a lot of jazz artists, and then in the 80s, he started working with jazz.
Jonathan Jazzo Birx is a rapper and producer who is best known for being Jay-Z's mentor. They met when Jay was 14. Jazz, only 4 years older, was already a legendary rapper in their native Marcy projects. Jazz would feature his younger neighbor on early songs like HP Gets Busy and The Originators. Jazz and Jay would work together consistently up until the late 1990s, when there began to be rumors of a falling out. These were confirmed in 2002 when Jay's reluctance to appear in the video for Jazz's song Let's Go caused Jazz to make his dissatisfaction with Jay public. The two have traded occasional barbs ever since.
I knew someone in Marcy Projects that lived right next to Jay-Z, his building. And one day, I don't know, I think my friend gave me Jazz's, I can't remember if he gave me Jazz's demo or I met Jazz and Jazz gave me his demo, but I passed it on to my father.
Do you remember around when this was, like around what
this
year?
This had to be in like early 80s, for sure it was early 80s. It was before 84, so I'll say it was probably like 81, 82, maybe. Around that time, early 80s, we became friends, Jazz and Jay and I, and they were like staples at my house, and they were always creating. And Dad, they did HP Gets Busy. Hawaiian Sophie, some different, actually styled Hawaiian Sophie. I said, aloha, baby, word like you're looking fly. I said, my name is Jazz, and she did amaze me when she said, the rapper get me and my partner, Jay-Z. My witness, wasn't she stacked?
Wasn't she pumping, slamming, working? So true and deep black. She said, oh, really? The famous video.
That everyone talks about. I don't know if I want to get credit for that now, because it's gotten so much crap over the years. But now I keep my eyes on the Judas. With Hawaiian Sophie fame, kept my name in his music. Check it out. Fuck with your soul like ether. Teach you the king, you know. But basically, we had a lot of good times. Those were their starting grounds, and they were best friends. And so we worked together, and my father worked with them as well. And D-Train. Also, he managed D-Train, which is one of my favorite, you know, singers to this day. We were in the studio the other night, so I want to shout out D-Train.
You know, during the 80s, you know, you were talking about when all this was kind of happening for you, and you were growing up and, you know, young teenager and stuff. I read an interview you did where you were talking about how there was this period back then when, you know, rap music and sort of the attendant hip-hop culture was kind of merging with like skating and surfing and all of it was kind of one big countercultural thing, which may seem weird to people around now and didn't experience that. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. It's interesting because today I feel like it's happening again in a different way. And it's so nostalgic for me. But the people that don't, like you said, that didn't even know about them, they're like, what are you talking about? So back in the late 80s, the early 90s, when I was first getting into fashion, there was this whole anti-establishment factor going on, right? You know, we were having the effects of the crack era, and there were a lot of different things going on. And I just think that young people particularly were connecting. And so those worlds intersected because we had a common denominator, and that was the anti-establishment factor, which really was, to me, encapsulated hip-hop in a lot of different ways. So at that time, I started manufacturing and I was traveling to the West Coast a lot. And then I was here. So I got to experience the NWA, the West Coast vibe and see how angry they were in those hoods and see like, oh, wow, they have all the same issues that we do on the East Coast, you know. And then at the same time, I saw the surf kids because, you know, Carl Jones, people don't know Cross Colors. Before Cross Colors, Carl Jones had a surf company.
In 1985, coming off a successful screen printing and t-shirt design business, Carl Jones founded a company called Surf Fetish. While he was running the business, he hired a young designer named Thomas T.J. Walker, who would go on to become his partner in Cross Colors, the brand they would launch in 1989. For Jones, Cross Colors was a way to broadcast political and social messages, such as denouncing gangs or calling for racial unity. The Cross Colors label, whose baseball caps, baggy jeans, and message-bearing t-shirts were to prove influential, also introduced such future designers as Carl Kanai.
I just saw, from Venice Beach and going to those places in the 80s, like, okay, those guys, there was all this connection with skate, with surf, and with hip hop, especially when I went to the trade show. So Magic was this trade show, the Men's Apparel Guild. It's a convention in Vegas that is huge. So people go and buy there twice a year. But the buyers were all buying the same thing, and it was this intersection that was happening. If you went to Prince Street back in about the early 90s, you could go. Susie was there, but right down the block was Fat Farm. I'd go to both, and the same customers would be at both. So there was this conversion taking place, and it was just like mine more than anything, you know, connecting and respecting each other's originality and differences, but still exchanging notes.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that because I remember from my point of view, a lot of the surf stuff kind of bleeding into hip-hop, the suburbs of New Jersey at that period, you know, all of a sudden we're wearing
absolutely
No Fear or whatever it is in the early 90s. You know, at that point, because I was young, I didn't see that intersection. It's interesting to see, like, sort of where that started.
And it was sports also. We can't forget sports. There was Paid, and that's how AM1 was spawned, a lot of that stuff. So it was just really all these different subcultures that existed within the culture that were being formed that came together.
You know, there was a guy who I honestly hadn't heard of before I started researching you, who sort of inadvertently helped kickstart your career, who set up the situation for you to meet Jam Master Jay, a guy named Miguel Navarro? Who was he?
Miguel Navarro was a very interesting character, Latino, out of Brooklyn, very famous in our local community, and he was into hip-hop. So I remember he was one of the first kids I knew from Brooklyn that I knew that came back with stories from Japan. He used to dance I can't remember if it was Kid and Play, but he got to dance. He was a great dancer, just a good person. We knew him from hanging out. That's how we originally connected. But then he was making clothes. So I had a custom shop in Brooklyn called Fashion and Effect. Miguel had a custom shop as well. Miguel was a lot more boisterous in his personality than me, but he was contagious behavior. You just fell in love with him. He was a good person. So we all knew each other. And I think it was me and him pretty much in Brooklyn at that time doing custom clothing. So we used to exchange notes and help each other with, you know where this fabric place is, or I need zippers. You know, we could call each other about whatever and share. You know, that was beautiful. But Miguel made clothes for everyone from hustlers to correction officers at that time to everyday people to celebrities. And we both had those same kind of customer bases. That was the 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say, you haven't been shy about, you know, talking about that era, saying that a lot of your clientele at Fashion by Design was hustlers.
Yeah, that was a period. You have to realize that it wouldn't be strange to see a celebrity with a hustler or a correction officer with the hustler back in the 80s. It was just this weird period that was going on, you know what I mean? It probably still exists, but it's not so overt now. But
right,
then it was just very, like, it was going down because the 80s were, like, it was an explosion of so much going on in the street. So people were figuring it out still, and they were very, I think there was a time where we were glamour, we didn't know it, but we were, like, very infatuated with the streets at that time. because, you know, you see those movies, New Jack City, those were just like amplifying what was going on in the street. So, you know, when it was like you were dying, we were dying and being annihilated out here by crack and all this other stuff, the murders, Yusef Hawkins and all this stuff was going on. You almost looked at them like superheroes, which was ignorant, but it was a fact, you know. It was just like, okay, they're sharing the wealth, even if they weren't, you know, it was a distorted, or you were rooting for the underdog in a sense, you know. So I think that it was a weird time and coming up, and when you felt despondent and like, what are the answers? So I don't know. Not making excuses, not being apologetic, and not being unapologetic. But yeah, I do say that the same way I'm saying this, I think the hustlers were rooting for us.
Well,
I hope they win. Yeah,
you,
I hope that, and Miguel and others that I know, you know, I think they were like, okay, I want you to make it, you know, and so they would support us, and green checks everywhere. So, you know, we definitely embrace the support.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that maybe a lot of people don't remember about that era is, unlike now when you have people who maybe did street stuff trying to get into the music business, it was the other way around. It was the rappers kind of going to the hustlers for credibility and appearing on album covers. Rappers at that point weren't making money like the hustlers were at that point.
Absolutely. It was reversed then. Yeah, it's true. And people forget. And one thing, you know, my father and my family have always taught me is to stay humble and to remember where you came from. And I think that I will always remember people that gave me, those were my roots, those were my stomping grounds and my start. So I can't forget that.
Yeah. And, you know, one of your first celebrity clients was one of former guests on our show, Milk D.
Ah, yeah, very cool.
Yeah,
Milk
he
is
gave
a
you
good
one
friend.
Of your first big breaks, right?
Yes, he did. Milk is a good guy as well. Milk and Giz.
Kirk, Milk D. Robinson was, with his brother Nat Gizmo Robinson, part of the group Audio 2, best known for their classic and off-sampled song, Top Billin'. The group's label, First Priority, which was run by their father, also put out albums by another sibling in the Robinson clan, MC Light.
Gizmo scratching, Milk D's rhyming, Milk is chilling, Giz is chilling. What more can I say? Top Billin', that's what we get. Got it good, since you understood, would you...
I became really good friends with them from that, but I knew Light, and I can't remember. I think Light might have been actually the one to signal them to come to the store. So Light and Jazzy Joyce, and at that time, it was a few people that were hanging out. We were all kicking it, and I can't remember if Light told them that, because we always debate on this, me and Milk, but someone told them about our shop in Brooklyn, and they were doing the I Don't Care. They needed outfits for the I Don't Care album cover. And they came in the shop together and had heard about the shop and said, can you make these outfits? And they were airbrushed. We airbrushed and hand-painted them, and we did leather, and it was white denim, and just really blinged them out, and they end up using them for the album cover. And that was a good look because it opened my eyes and opened my world to the concept of styling and really got me started with the styling division.
You can see the cover of Audio 2's 1990 record, I Don't Care, the album, in the show notes for this episode at theciphershow.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing thing is, you know, even after you opened Walker Wear, you kept styling. You had a styling and consulting business going the whole time you
Absolutely.
Were running. I don't know if you split yourself in half or cloned yourself or what the deal
teamwork,
was.
Teamwork.
How did you keep both of those going?
So I have to give a lot of credit at that time to Nicole Walker, who was working with me. And Nicole was just this amazing, organized person. And she also loved custom. And so I was able to maintain both because I had another arm with me. And she, you know, that was also a passion area of hers. So between us exchanging ideas together and her kind of managing the custom, I was able to go to those meetings at the record companies and land those accounts for styling. And, you know, I think that another thing besides the business side of it is we were the culture at that time. There weren't like people think of styling now, it was so different back in late 80s, early 90s. You were still fighting for a budget for styling because...
They just say like, oh, why doesn't he wear what he wears every day?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly what the record companies were doing with artists. They were going, telling them to show up and wear their outfit that they like. And the styling was just kicking in, so artists were already fighting for stylists to like, no, I want a styling budget, you know, because there were other genres of music that had styling budgets. And so when we connected with the artists, when we were able to meet artists, I think part of the beauty of it, right, is that we were living that lifestyle. So we really made a genuine connection. And our thing wouldn't be like, let me just style your stuff. We would really have to feel their music. So if we felt their music, we would say, some great ideas, you know, and that would be the start of the conversation. And then we'd say, come in, and we'd do a listening session. And then we'd ask to see their wardrobe, you know, to see.
Start with the artist's actual
and
wardrobe.
We want to see what's your day like with you? Who are you? You know, those are important things when you think about styling. And I think it's changed so much. You know, I believed in keeping them in their comfort zone and stretching them. I didn't believe in just making them shiny suits and taking them out of who they were completely, because I think that when you're uncomfortable, it translates.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of your favorite, you know, videos that you have done styling for that you look back on and you're like, wow, I did a really good job that really fits, you know, the artist. I know obviously styles have changed since
it's
you were doing a lot
so
of
much,
the
right?
styling, but you know, so that, even that said, you know, what are some your favorites?
Of them? Okay. So, I remember Tupac did this video. I can't remember the name of it. I'm terrible right now. But it was after Brenda's Got a Baby. And he's wearing all these hooded denim suits. What's the name of this song?
April is likely talking about the video for Tupac's song, If My Homie Calls.
Yeah, but that was one of them. It was a great... I love that. And I don't know if it was just I was excited because I got... No, but that was a dope video. And I don't think... That one gets a lot of credit. It was one of his first independent. I think that's really where the connection is for me. Videos after he left digital.
Mm-hmm.
And then Above the Rim, movie-wise.
See your brother, Birdie? He used to be. What does that mean? Look, just because a motherfucker is born into your family don't mean you stay family, all right? That motherfucker ain't shit.
I got to... put a lot of those outfits together. So that was really probably one of my favorites, like the camouflage outfit in that. And there's another scene, he has a hooked vest on. I did that. And so that was definitely fun, you know, in terms of videos, Down with the King.
About 10 of them. Recruiting suckers, Mac and Mike, and making men of them. Tears and fears for my peers. They risen. You think that it is, if not, it isn't.
It's not about like necessarily the best outfit we did, but just that whole vibe in that video. I think that was definitely one of my favorites.
Speaking of videos, you know, the director Hype Williams, very famous video director, actually did his first video in your apartment, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy. What was the video?
It was for PM Dawn. Actually, I can't remember the song, but it was for PM Dawn.
Noted video director Hype Williams directed PM Dawn's 1993 video for Ways of the Wind, Cash Money Groove Mix.
I knew Hype since he was, I don't know if he was even, he was interning, I think. I met Hype at Classic Concepts. So people that don't know, Hype actually used to intern and then work and then grew his way up to managing and really being one of the premier directors for Classic Concepts, which was Lionel Martin and Ralph McDaniels. They had a very big video company that did tons and tons of videos.
Right.
Welcome to New York's number one video show, Video Music Box, the box that rocks.
Ralph McDaniels and Lionel Vidkid Martin are perhaps best known as the co-creators and hosts of the influential Video Music Box TV show, the first series to regularly feature rap videos.
Did they end up wearing walker wear or fashion by design stuff in the video?
No, actually, that's a funny story. We didn't do that video because we lent him the apartment. It was his first video, so we were friends, but we didn't work with him on that because PM Dawn just didn't fit. We didn't feel as a brand fit the profile of Walkaway and what Walkaway represented. I love that song they mm-hmm. did. You know, I love the artist, but we really wanted to keep consistency. I'm big on brand consistency. And at that time, I felt like it would throw my consumer and the artist that were representing the product off. So we chose to sit that one out.
Yeah. And, you know, around that era, Naughty by Nature, you did a lot of styling stuff for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally considered the first hip-hop artist to have their own clothing line, own retail store.
Right.
What was your involvement in that?
I helped them in terms of merchandising, in terms of their ideation, and just helped them where they needed it. That when they decided they were going to start the store, Naughty Gear, they had a store in Newark. I remember we stayed up all night, like merchandising the store, putting it together.
Wow. The good so thing about it, building the store,
yeah, they already were doing, yeah, all of that. Like I remember, I think I blew up a really big picture that I sent them for the store when they opened. That was over their register. I don't know. I was styling Naughty for years. I was blessed. I was able to work with them, and they're one of my favorite hip hop groups to this day. But great group of guys, so creative. All of them had different lanes. So Vinny, he decided his lane would be merchandising and fashion. Mm-hmm. Tretch was acting, and KG was producing. So right. They agreed on those three categories. And so me and Vinny connected a lot on the business because I was in fashion. So whenever he had a problem, and then later after he got it together, because Vinny's quick and he's sharp as can be, I ended up calling him sometimes like, hey, do you have a vendor for X or Y, you
wow.
know, so.
Amazing. And, you know, but to get to, you know, actually the clothes, how would you, the stuff you were doing at Fashion by Design and even kind of maybe into the right. early ideations of walker wear, how would you describe the clothes you were making?
So my clothes varied. It was all custom in the very beginning, which hindsight I learned. I was actually test marketing. I didn't know I was going to create a brand, but from that experience, it was great because I learned about product placement. I learned about test marketing to know what worked. So with the custom business, you have to realize a customer, and that customer would range from a blue collar to a white collar to, like I said, the hustle scene to celebrities to it was a wide range, a big ocean in terms of the customers. And they would come in and ask for different things. But the one thing I got to see is what people would repeatedly ask for. So at that time, deeper pockets, more leg room, bootleg cuts, you know, those are the things I listened to. And from those, that's how I started making my first denim suits for walkerwear. Mm-hmm. Kept hearing those same things.
That's so interesting because, you know, stuff that has a bigger fit, more pocket room, a little more room in the crotch or whatever, the kind of baggy fit, has at this point, you know,
right.
been a trend, been parodied, you know,
so much.
Gone out of fashion, maybe
absolutely.
Come back. And it's sort of incredible to think of that not that long ago, it didn't exist.
Right.
And that, you know, people like you had to invent it based on what their clientele wanted.
Right.
Was anyone else doing that at the time you started doing it?
So as I remember, I had a custom shop in Brooklyn, and there was another guy by the name of Carl Kanai that was out of Flatbush, and he was actually, you know, he went to the West Coast. He was actually doing ads in Word Up at that time and Write On. In the back of the magazine, he would have his Carl Kanai designs, and you could actually order it by telephone, an 800 number. And that's how we both were. I was doing mine with my shop, and he was basically doing, you know, 800 numbers in the magazine. And we were both figuring it out at that time. I think he was savvy enough to know that Brooklyn wasn't the answer in terms of mass production at that time. So he got on a plane and went to the West Coast. Mm-hmm. But I actually knew Carl before he left. So he was another one. We started exchanging information, you know, as soon as he started, and we kept in touch throughout.
And so you two were kind of some of the pioneers of that kind of style.
Absolutely.
Amazing. And in terms of what stuff, you know, looked like patterns and stuff, Willie Smith of Willie Wear was a big influence on you.
Willie Smith founded his Willie Wear brand in 1976. The brand, with its bold, experimental, still affordable looks, was a huge success through the late 1980s. The peak of Smith's pop culture influence came in 1987 when he designed Mary Jane Watson's wedding dress when she, or at least an actress playing her, got married to Spider-Man at Shea Stadium. Smith died of complications related to AIDS that same year.
I looked at some of his designs, you know, what I could see, old print ads and stuff. And it's pretty crazy. There's like, you know,
his plaid and all this kind of stuff. The mismatched.
Yeah.
And there was a long period where I was just wearing Willie Wear. I love the concept. And it's funny, I think some of that inspiration came from my father, because there was this time in the 80s where you were matching everything. Mm-hmm. And so I was big on matching. And I never forget going to school one day and my father was like, "What are you doing? Like, don't be that girl, you know?" And he was just like, "It's cool to mix it up. Like, don't, styling is not one color." Like, and I just remember being so offended that day. But I think... I think he really, really did slap me in the face in a good way, because my father would wear polka dots with stripes and, you know, and he'd wear his fedoras or whatever it was. He wasn't afraid to wear different things, and it just was style. And so that's where I got the concept kicked in, style over fashion. And I started learning that from that point. And now I'm admitting it, Dad. But
you were right all along, Dad.
but I think that's something that Willie Smith did brilliantly, and I give him a lot of credit for going out, and he'd be like right on the ledge and be like, "Yes, beating his chest. This is who we are, you know, this is what I'm feeling today."
And, you know, in the 80s and 90s, as you were kind of getting started, there were big regional differences in fashion, right? People in California dress different than people in, you know, Chicago, and within New York, within Absolutely. Different boroughs, there were even differences in fashion. You know, we saw that, you know, Sasha's movie Fresh Dress laid mm-hmm. that out very clearly.
Here's a clip from episode 124 guest Sasha Jenkins' documentary, Fresh Dress.
Guy from Brooklyn would have on Clarks, shark skins, Cazal glasses with no lens in it, and a Kangol crease, like, I don't know what. That was a Brooklyn cat. He didn't have to say anything. You knew he was from Brooklyn. A guy from Harlem would have on, let's say, a velour sweatsuit. And whatever brand the sweatsuit was from, he would have the sneaker to match. Same with the Bronx. The Bronx was a mix of Harlem and Brooklyn together. Queens had their own flow, too.
You know, Definitely. The differences in fashion in each borough. What's happened to those kind of regional differences? Do they still exist now that it's, you know, so much easier to communicate between different regions?
They probably do in their own way. I personally think it's changed so much. I think it's gone away on the whole, like generalizing. Definitely it's a night and day difference from those days, because we didn't have the internet. And prior to the internet, we had MTV. MTV, Yo MTV Raps was a game changer for fashion in urban, in the metropolitan scene around the world, because what it did was bring some context to the neighborhoods. Like I said, I felt like I was one of the fortunate ones to get on a plane early and go to the West Coast and be able to experience that. But a lot of people didn't know that. They didn't see that. So when NW came out, I think that's why they kind of shocked the nation, you know, because you could only imagine what they were going through their music, right? But you really didn't know. So when I went out there after hearing the songs, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, you know, visual is everything, right?
Yeah.
So imagine when Yo MTV Raps came out and you saw these neighborhoods around the country through video representations of Dickies and Chuckies. And, you know, you got to see like, oh, okay, wow, their style is so different. You know, this is what they represent.
Chilling out with NWA and Compton. What's up, y'all? Yo, everybody give me a little shout out. Let me know who you are.
Ice Cube, the gangster gangster.
Dr. Dre.
Lay Law.
DJ Speed.
D.O. to the C.
MC Ran, a ruthless villain.
DJ Yellow.
And of course, my man right here. What's up?
Eazy-E, the hip-hop thugster.
And then after a while, artists became so influential that whatever they were wearing,
everyone started wearing.
Yeah. So it became like this uniform of white t-shirts, jeans, and Tims, you know. And so,
hasn't changed that much.
It's exactly. And I think that's the tragic part, you know, about the internet and media and just all these mediums that exist that ultimately end up controlling us. And I think it just dumbs us down in that way.
Yeah. Now, when you launched Walker Wear officially, I think in 92,
right?
What was the hip hop fashion, urban fashion, whatever inexact term we want to use for it? What was that world like? Like, were there any other companies? Was it still the era when people were kind of repurposing, you know, polo and stuff like that?
Right. At that time, the climate was pretty much, you had Timberlands, you had Calvin Klein. There was not a lot of choices for us. So that is why I wanted to do Walker Wear. A big influence for Walker Wear, because I was traveling East and West Coast, and people say, I can't tell whether you have a lot of West Coast influences as well. It's because I was bi-coastal. I didn't look at it as one neighborhood even then, you know. I just really was representing urban culture more than anything and had listening ears. I heard the voice of people who wanted more, but they weren't being serviced. So that was the premise of it. And like I said, at that time, it's like right now, like we have skinny jeans and things are very fitted and people wanted a change. I think that's life, right? They come in cycles, like especially fashion. So we'll have a change again. It might not ever go back to baggy pants, but it definitely could become more relaxed again. And, you know, it's just history prevails. That's what happens. My mom, I remember when I used to wear stuff and my mom would be like, oh, we had that. And I'd be like, yeah, right, you know. And now I'm like dying for some of those things. So it's just like it happens.
Yeah. And, you know, so you very first trade show with Walker Wear, Namsby Convention, you bring your, at that point, good friend Jam Master Jay, who was a big supporter.
Absolutely.
You bring him, you get, you know, 10 buyers in the room, they go nuts. You get 300 grand worth of orders, and then you run into the actual fashion business. What happened at that point that you're facing, you know, six figures worth of clothes that people want you to make?
So let me start by saying I met Jay at Kilimanjaro's, and he became one of my biggest supporters. And he also became an advocate and an ambassador, really pushing the brand. And he was nice enough to come to the Namsby show. I didn't actually do the show because it was my first trade show introduction. So I was afraid to actually get on the floor because I didn't know what the whole experience would be like at that time.
So you're in a hotel room or something?
We did a suite a few blocks away.
Yeah.
And so we invited 10 buyers thinking they wouldn't all show up, and they all showed up. And at that time it was big shops. So it was, big accounts like Merry-Go-Round that had 2000 doors, and you had Dr. J's, which had like at that time, 10 stores that seemed like 1,000 now,
sure.
You know, you know, and different stores and some mama and papas that were influential. So they came, and I can't say that if Jay wasn't there, all of them would have bought. At that time, we were bubbling, so I'm sure some of them would have. But he really was instrumental in getting behind the brand and saying, no, you need this, you know. And from that experience, they all bought. And I think my first trade show, that experience, we probably held paper of about $300,000 that day, which was a lot. It's still, today, for me, a lot. So I remember in 90, early 90s, that was a lot. But that experience, I was green, so I didn't understand the concept. I did understand the concept of purchase order financing, but I didn't know that at that time, without 3 years of financials, in terms of I just started Walkaware, that I couldn't get green lit. So I had this all this paper in my hand that I couldn't translate into dollars to actually get the financing to actually deliver.
Wow. So you had people willing to buy the clothes, but not the means to make them.
Right. So then I found out about, like they said, there's always the loan shark. There was a loan shark for purchase order financing. So I figured, okay. And they make it a lot more appealing until you have the paper and then they give you the real paperwork. So that second experience was like that. I went back and I remember I went to Magic this time, but instead I was like, well, I'm not going to do the show. I'm going to rent a room in Bally's. And I did the same thing. And I wrote paper all night. And then the loan shark that I was counting on changed the terms. And it was like, okay, that doesn't make sense. If I do get the paper, then I'm going to be owing you and not making
right.
any money.
You know, all these orders, so, you don't get to keep any money.
So, you know, it was definitely a learning experience. And if I was giving advice to anyone, I would say definitely make sure everything's legit and you know what you're doing. And a lot of stuff is harder, you know, for us, to be honest. You know, it's like we don't get offered the same deals a lot of times. So you got to really do the due diligence and work harder to find those options and make sure they work for you in business before you put yourself out there.
Sure. And, you know, you were facing any number of difficulties, you know, three strikes against you in some
right.
ways, being very young
right.
at that point, being Black and being a woman.
Right.
In a business where, you know, the people handling the money are none of those things.
Right. And then on top of that, it was hip hop. And you have to realize hip hop was perceived as hip hop
mm-hmm.
because it was really me just making clothes for an audience.
Right.
But that was considered of other at that time and was very nervous. You know, I remember that first show at Namsby. I remember someone asking me why my velour sweatsuits were the same prices as Fila. Because Fila was an Italian designer, and I wasn't. I remember them
wow.
saying that, you know. So it was constantly that. It was constantly asking me, why should they buy this? And the next year, the music might be gone, and no one will care. You know, it right. wasn't proven yet. So it was so interesting, that time period.
Yeah. And, you know, so you very quickly you got into department stores. Within a couple of years, what was that scene like dealing with department store buyers?
It was very corporate. So we were always careful not to sell too many department stores because we knew early on that being in department stores could kill our business, especially then. It's a different world now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It still matters, but not like it did then. I think that...
What would be bad about being in too many department stores?
But the guys shopping in a department stores aren't the cool guys. The cool guys are the ones that are in those tastemaker, in the cut spots that know about the spots no one else knows about. And those are the guys that are like the stars of the hoods and that everyone looks up to, that Kanye actually follows. You know what I mean? That's the thing. They're the real influencers, the real, real influencers. So you want to have their attention. And I think the minute you get to the department store is the minute they don't want to buy your stuff anymore because then it's too accessible. So just with that theory, we also have to remember, as a business, in any business, you have to make money and there has to be balance. So the formula we figured out early on was that we couldn't not sell some of the machines because those guys, like those small little image tastemaker stores that it's important to support and be in their stores, at the same time, they're buying either off their own personal credit cards or six at a time, which are not going to make you rich or have a business.
Right.
But you need them. You want, and that's 80 at that time was more than 80% of your business. With a lot of bounce checks and deliveries coming back COD, mm-hmm. you will go out of business. So we figured out, okay, you know what? That was my whole premise, besides the fact that at that time Robert Horry and Shaq and cats like that were calling me because there weren't options for them. So we were custom making clothing for a lot of the NBA players, Gary Payton, Jimmy Jackson, all those guys at that time, Derek Coleman. So the audience was there for us and they were finding us. We also figured they're a part of this culture and they want it because they were big advocates. So we said, why not create like this sports program, which we had sports fashion influence items and silhouettes that we sprinkled in our brand. Now we took that and we packaged it and we sold it, a piece of the brand, to Foot Action and Foot Lockers and guys like that.
Oh, okay.
That basically would get it because they're part of the culture and they pay bills. And the same thing with, we're only going to sell 4 federated stores, but they pay bills. You know what I mean? So that was the concept.
Interesting. Now, you know, another big part of your brand obviously was product placement. You talked about, you know, having stuff on MTV Raps and so forth. At a certain point, Viacom brought the hammer down on that, right?
Right, they did. I remember getting, I wish, because we're doing so many interesting things now, that I was a rat pack in terms of saving everything. But they actually sent me a letter that said they would no longer let me product place. And it just was like so eye-opening for me, like, wow, they're really paying attention. And I was doing a lot of product placement at that time in terms of, I don't even know if it was so much product placement in terms of, I was getting a lot of love at that time.
Mm-hmm. Not even necessarily people you set up to wear your pieces.
Right, they were just wearing it. Yeah. And so it was popping up in videos. And I know that now because I get people that inbox me on Facebook, particularly with a video or something that I've never seen, you know. and I'm like, wow, like that's so crazy. But they sent me a letter and they just said it. That's when they started that blurry thing. That was as a result. I know I was definitely one of the brands because they sent me a letter. And right after that, I saw the blurry thing. So it could have been me, Kanai. I'm sure Kanai probably got one of those letters because we were both product placing and being in a lot of those videos. And they said, unless you start paying us, don't expect to see your logo.
Amazing. And you did have, you know, before that, a lot of people wearing your stuff in videos and so forth. And one, you know, one rapper who was obviously photographed wearing your stuff a lot was Biggie, who you first met when he was a chubby kid trying to buy your stuff on layaway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He started, actually, he grew up in my neighborhood. So I knew him. He was a neighbor. But I knew him from, like, the kid that was posted up at the train station on Washington and Fulton Street in Brooklyn, and I lived a few blocks away. So I used to see him. I was a few years older. I'd always see him coming out. It's so funny. So to give you guys a visual, so there's two entrances at the train station. So Clinton and Fulton is 2 blocks away from Washington and Fulton. But back in the 80s, vast difference in terms of where you had to come out. At nighttime, it would be the Clinton side was always closed, so you had to come out at Washington. And Washington was like nothing good right there. You knew when you came upstairs, you better be on alert, look both ways, walk fast, and have a grill face. And him and his crew would always be out there, and I'd see them a lot. Luckily, I knew some of his crew. And so one day he just slowly walked in the store and started looking at the walls, and we struck a conversation. And that was the beginning of a really great relationship because creatively we definitely connected, and he went on to do so many great things and became one of the illest of all time. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing to me is you see this kid, and then, you know, within, yeah, I don't know, 7 to 10 years or something, he's
covered so much ground.
Right. Got signed, got famous, became a star, made 2 great albums, and then got murdered all within this incredibly short span of time.
Lived a lifetime in that short time.
Yeah. Another big person who wore your clothes and who you work with a lot was Mike Tyson.
Right.
I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the first person to have someone wear, you know, non-Everlast stuff in a title fight.
Absolutely. That was a surreal moment. It's so funny you say that because last night we did our first speakeasy. So during the holidays, we're doing speakeasies. You guys have to come out to one of them. Thursday nights, they're private. Our first one was with Team Tyson, some of the cast members of Team Tyson. And we just shared stories about what boxing was like then and working with Mike and that whole experience.
But Team Tyson was your sportswear brand. You had collaboration with it. Right.
So actually, Mike was actually partnered up with me for a time with Walkerwear. And I was also working with him on Team Tyson. And so last night, some of the guys that actually worked in his camp with Team Tyson actually came and spoke about them working with Mike, and then we touched on working together as well. But it was interesting. But yeah, that moment in the ring was the biggest moment for me. One of those moments that you can remember where you were. It was at the fight when he walked in and just like, wow, we made it. That's how I feel, you know, that moment. Like, it was just like, wow, because Mike just represented so many different things, I think, for so many people, but especially a kid coming from Brooklyn.
Now, is it true you snuck a banner up, guerrilla style, in the press conference?
Yeah, absolutely. MGM Grand. I remember, I have to credit Gordy for that. One of the Team Tyson members called me like, hurry up, you got a banner, bring it down now to the MGM, I'm gonna get you. We did. So that's how that worked.
Amazing.
I have a picture of that. Yeah,
right.
We had some crazy moments.
Mm-hmm. You had something, I saw a brief mention in the paper in the New York Times back in this era, like 96, about something you were working on with Mike Tyson that was going to be called the Alliance of Minority Designers.
Right.
What was that? And did that ever come to fruition?
So, yeah, I actually had Alliance of Minorities before Mike, but when I told him about it, he was very excited about that as well and wanted to be a part of that. So we did a few different meetings with that. We did one here in New York City, and we did one at Bally's in Vegas. And the premise of Alliance of Minority Designers was just really forming a community for the urban culture and this urban fashion category that existed, that was really getting a lot of deals, but really not empowering other designers. And at that time, we were starting to make some traction. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, let's create this pot. The same problem, perfect example, what I just told you about the purchase order financing and me having a problem. Mm-hmm. Let's pull our money together and create this pot that exists. So for other designers that we believe in, they might not have this problem. Or let's share our distribution problem. So if I can't afford 10,000 yards of denim, but I need bull denim, but someone else is making bull denim, let's put our stuff together and make that order collectively. And now we become stronger. But it was just too hard.
Yeah, this...
It was a very John Lennon
kind
of thinking.
What I'm interested in is sort of the ending of Walkerwear. It gets to be like 1999 or so, and you get a sense that this is all going downhill. There are too many brands. There are artists starting to make cash grabs with fashion lines and so forth. You feel like this is all on its way out. And you do something very interesting, which is you grab a camera and start documenting. You're like, I know this is the end. Let me take pictures while the ship is sinking. Like, what gave you the idea to do that?
Well, I just saw corporate exploitation. I saw, just like in every other culture of the creative arts, I think once corporate America sees how they make money off of it, the creative process gets diluted. And so I saw that happening in fashion, and I'd already seen it in music. They closed all the black music divisions at that time a few years prior, but it was very synonymous, the timeline. I saw a lot of creative people making bad decisions in fashion because they were starting to, it's like the tide turns. So when you're being led by creativity, I think once you start just being led by the dollars, it's a wrap, you know, in any environment. So I fell in love with it out of the passion, being young and being naive and being stumbled across it. It was almost a mistake, honestly, you know, but it was the best mistake I made of my life. But so to really build up to making all this money and then seeing what you fell in love with get pimped out, so to speak, you're just like, okay, I need a timeout. It was a battle within. I started being very unhappy, and people were congratulating me, the outside world. But inside, I felt so pressured because I had so much to maintain and manage. And it was really just business and me not being able to be creative at that time. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously on the macrocosm of the industry, it was just the same thing was happening. So I said, let me grab a camera. I had this vision to at least get the history of urban fashion. I didn't know that it was gonna completely fold, but I wanted to show the change of what was going on and kind of how it came from this nothing existence when I started to being this billion-dollar plus industry that was turning into a circus. And then it went past the circus. It's funny how you decide I want to do a doc, and then it takes a life of its own, mm-hmm. and it just becomes something else. And that's what happened, because by the time I finished the idea of it, it already had crashed. And like you said, it just was like, well, urban fashion is a bad word. Don't say that. We're not urban, you know? And I'm like, wow.
So whatever happened to the footage?
I have the footage. I own the footage, and I actually have decided to do a series instead, which is going to be fashion films about different fashion designers that will talk about. I hooked up with two amazing partners, Earl Christian and Alan Carton, and they both are in film. So they teamed up with me, and we are putting together these fashion films. The first few are in the can, so we're doing one on myself, one on Willie Eskel, PNB Nation, Tony Shellman, who created Mecca, Nietzsche, and Parish Nation. We're going to do one on Starter. We have a laundry list of different cast of characters, but they're basically meet, like, if you think about it, think Unsung meets 30 for 30, mm-hmm. and they're about different fashion, people who have impacted our culture.
And, you know, one thing to go along with these films is, I think, late 2012, early 2013, you relaunched Walkerwear, mm-hmm. Which is great. You had this kind of tension when you came back.
Right.
You know, hadn't done Walkerwear in, you know, 12 years, 13 years by that point. Probably had a ton of ideas, new things you wanted to try, and people just wanted the old stuff. Yeah. What was that like?
It was like getting on a bike but falling again, you know, and then getting back up and brushing your knees. And, okay, I remember this. That's exactly what it was like, but not in a bad way. The exciting part was having this digital platform. That was the premise of why I came back, along with extending my portfolio, along with knowing the time was right. And the biggest thing was I have a consulting company called A. Walker Group, and I have a lot of creative clients. So I was ghostwriting behind the scenes from 2006 in terms of design. But a lot of our clients don't listen. I'm happy about getting paid and working with these creative people, but at the same time, it's frustrating when people don't listen. And you're like, if I had this brand, and I'm like, I do have equity in this brand on the shelf. So dust it off. It's the right time. I just really took it as a canvas to paint. But then what happened was I said, I can do this again because I don't have to play the retail games that exist. And I can cut the middleman and grow this out organically. And I saw hip hop, and I don't want to see hip hop, but our culture period, there's a disconnect between the two generations. And I wanted to create that conversation through fashion.
Yeah. What was getting the retail side of it together like? Because that was the one part of the business you never had to deal with.
Right,
you had to
right.
make the clothes, but then other people would sell them, and now all of a sudden you're selling them. What was that side of it like to learn?
That's, I think my biggest thing is getting to the customers, because it's so exciting, the possibilities, and we're definitely connecting with the audience. I think timing is everything, so I need to connect more and more and more, and I'm doing it in learning more ways. But I think that for me, the potential is infinite in terms of the possibilities and the consumers out there and the audience, because it really is more of a loyalty movement. You know, fashion is fashion. There's so many great choices out there. It's just what you really, how you express yourself, right? So I think that's the exciting point, being able to get that across and create that canvas and that movement.
And what are some of the differences between the stuff you're selling now and the original designs?
Today I have on a vintage hoodie. This is one of the ones that we made back in the 90s, and it's our bestseller. And then, like you said, I had to really just analyze. The biggest thing I think about being a business person over anything creative is understanding business. So it is frustrating when you make 30 things and people ask for 5. But the thing is, are you going to listen, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's going to keep you in business. And so I've downsized, and we definitely are making those things. But we also had to come back to, I think I was so, like you said, sat out on the bench for so long. You come back, it's like a painter. You just want to paint, you want to paint, you want to paint. But people remember you for the vibe of your brand. And we were always about classics, basics, earth tones, and giving people quality and durability. So putting that in context, that's what we do now. Mm-hmm. You know, even the new stuff, it's pretty much timeless pieces that you can wear over time.
Interesting. And you know, I do have to ask this. What on earth was it like to hear your brand shouted out by Beavis of Beavis and Butthead fame?
Sean is kicking himself because the Mike Judge created idiot who's shouting out Walker Wear here is actually Butthead. Oh, yeah. Bill Walker.
Yo, Beavis. You're roughing up my Walker Wear.
No way, Butthead. You're wrinkling my fresh gear.
Oh, that was another moment, right? You remember those moments. Those are the moments. So, yeah, that was amazing. And that was like a call I got. I remember the Tracy Jordan, shout out to Tracy Jordan. She's at Sirius now, but she used to be at Motown, and she was actually the person, I think she was working on that project as well. She's actually the person that called me and gave me the heads up, like, hey, you know, she needed a clearance for something. And I was like, Beavis and Butthead? Like, okay, I'll take that, you know? So it was really cool. That just is like, those moments where you're like, okay, you're really impacting, and you don't really see the impact because it's hardest to see when you're sitting inside of yourself. But when you get those confirmations, you're like, wow.
To kind of briefly go through some of the other stuff you did, you worked at Fat Farm for a while. What were you doing over there?
So I was the VP, and I worked right under Russell, and I did all manage. Fat Farm was all licensing. So I managed all of the licensing partners we had in the divisions, and just really handled a lot of stuff that Russell needed me to take care of running the company.
And you worked for And One for a bit.
Mm-hmm. I helped them create a women's division there. They wanted to go into women's, or they thought they wanted to go into
women's. Which is something you hadn't done. Like, all your stuff before that had been all menswear.
Except I did dabble with walkerwear. So I had walkerwear pieces that were women's back in when we were doing it the first time. But I never had, like you said, it was always primarily menswear. So this was like, I always wanted to do women's though. So it was my opportunity to do it. Mm-hmm. But they didn't understand women's because their sports brand, and they thought they wanted to do it. But when they got in it, they were like, maybe not so much. So,
yeah. Interesting. So why didn't you ever make a full women's line sort of during the heyday of Walker Wear?
It was always our intention, but we wanted to focus on one thing and do it really well first, and then to branch out. And by the time we were ready to branch out, I was ready to get out. So that's what happened.
And, you know, as a proud pet owner, I have to ask about your time. You opened a pet boutique and had a pet food line for a while.
Yes, I love pets. And I live in Fort Greene in Brooklyn. If any of you know that, I've been there. I went to Bishop Laughlin in Brooklyn Tech. So I'm a diehard Brooklyn, Fort Greene person and Clinton Hill. And I saw maybe 99 pre-gentrification. I saw it coming. And I knew that I was going to be changing hands. And so I took a year off to just breathe after I walked away from Walkerwear. And I really was like, you know what? I don't want to deal with humans for a while. And then I knew what I was passionate about. My other passion was just a love for pets. And then I said, I just need to be able to USA. And that was my USA. So the concept was this beautiful, all-natural pet boutique that I could really stylize. And I love what we did with that shop. And it actually was located right next to Habana Outpost in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow. Okay. I know that, that spot. Yeah, of course.
And we created this beautiful luxury store that was very all-natural and at the same time warm. And creating an environment where you could buy all natural or organic food treats. And we made all natural and stylized products. So we had beautiful beds down to leashes, collars, coats, and all natural homeopathic products for cats, for dogs. And, you know, we did that. We did the retail. But from that, we realized where the margins were. And those were in the treats and the food. So we started a pet food and product, a family business called Papa Jack's with food and products, and a pet sitting business that we still have.
Wow. Interesting. And, you know, speaking of businesses and starting businesses and entrepreneurship, on your, you know, on Instagram, your website, YouTube, you have these like 10 to 15 second little inspirational messages called Walker Gems.
Whether it's you personally or you being an extension of your brand, BYOB, be your own brand at all times, especially because of social media. Can you believe in the dream when no one else will? Can you make naysayers yaysayers? Are you willing to get up in the early morning, go to bed late at night? Are you willing to fight for it, give your blood, sweat, and tears? That's an entrepreneur.
Why'd you start to do that? What purpose do you want them to serve?
So I think that Walker Gems is important because, like, I see it growing. There's all these online tools, and I think education is something we're going to see vastly change this third sector of technology. It's changing and exponentially the way we think about knowledge, the way we learn, and where we're going to go from here in terms of apps and everything. So I think it's important to be in the game, but I also think that when I look at the target market, it's for existing brands that are somewhere because they can afford to pay for a certain amount for classes. But I know that for Latinos, for African Americans, for the culture beginning entrepreneur that can't afford to pay for a class, that little 10 or 15 second is just enough to bring the light bulb and turn on a switch for you to now be able to go to Google and do the rest if you really want it. And so that's what it's really geared for. We do have a consulting company, so maybe it will spark a nerve for you to be like, hey, I'm really interested in what else she has to say. So you can check out the consulting services. That is a paid, you know, service, and a lot of people can't afford that. So I'm just really trying to help you get over that hump to go from beginning to mid-size.
Great. And, you know, finally, what else is coming up? I know you have the pop-up, you know, speakeasies planned throughout Brooklyn for the winter. What else is going on?
So, yeah, I'm really excited about our pop-up experiences, and those are 25 years with Walkaware. So we're going to be doing exclusive hours, appointment only. We started at my place, actually, so we're doing them there. So it's a whole experience. Thursday nights, we do these private speakeasies, which are moments in time with Walkaware and in our timeline of hip-hop. And as well, I have a fashion series that's going to be dropping in 16. Very excited about that. Some other upcoming fashion film projects. And I'm going to be extending my canvas with Walker Gems next year. So not only the 15 seconds, but you'll actually have webinars and classes and things you can actually learn and participate in, along with some speaking engagements and books. So I'm excited.
Excellent. Well, April Walker, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
I never would have imagined myself being captivated by the ups and downs of the fashion world, but talking to April about her experiences, that's exactly what happened. Her journey from a small custom shop to the top of the food chain and her current plan to rise again is totally fascinating. As if one successful business wasn't enough, It's crazy to me that during Walker Wears heyday, she ran both a clothing line and a styling business. It's enough to make me rethink ever telling anyone I'm too busy. Join us next week when we have our annual Christmas episode with the king of Christmas music, former Def Jam exec Bill Adler. We'll talk about, and hear, this year's edition of his world-famous Christmas Jollies mixtape, and a whole lot else besides. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I've decided to do a series instead.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
But the thing is, are you going to listen?
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He really, really did slap me in the face in a good way.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He wasn't afraid to wear different things, and it just was style.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Carl Petroff.
I had all this paper in my hand that I couldn't translate into dollars to actually get the financing to actually deliver.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Did I not cover something? I want to make sure you got everything.